Okay, and it is now 7:30. We are recording with the permission of our guest speaker, and I'm going to turn it over to Guy Brandenburg, our NCAA president.
Hi, I'm unfortunate enough to be the current NCAA president, and my name is Dr. Vandenberg. And just a couple of notes I have. We have recent sidewalk astronomy in a couple of places. One is the Congressional Cemetery on Capitol Hill, and that was a lot of fun. Also happened to be a beautiful, clear, sunny day, so this was a daytime thing. And Zach Gleiberman and Gail Gomez have been doing sidewalk astronomy in the Adams Morgan area. And you think about 16th Street and Irving Street in the middle of Adams Morgan. Gail, using an app called Astro Hopper, is able to find not only Saturn and Jupiter, which you don't need much to find, but also things like Uranus and Neptune and the Pleiades. And you can't see any of those things naked eye from there, not even the Pleiades. So it's pretty amazing what they're doing. There's no exploring the sky until April. And I want to stop here. Does anybody have any other announcements that they would like to make? Anybody online have any announcements? Okay. The speaker that we're going to have, Dr. Jeff Chester, you'll hear more about him from our Vice President Carl Baggetti. But Jeff used to be NCAA president back in the 80s, right?
Somewhere back in the early 80s, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And you're
Yeah, it
also.
was four. I suddenly realized it was like 40 years ago, and I was like,
Yeah.
oh God,
I look back in the index of Stardust. And that was pretty impressive. That was before my time.
How were your Zoom meetings back then?
Nobody
Sorry, what'd you
ever
say,
heard of
David?
them.
He was asking what were the Zoom meetings like back
Oh
then?
yeah, right.
We
Well,
used videos.
back then we used to meet in the Department of Commerce auditorium. And down at 14th Street in the Commerce Building, it was a really, really cool auditorium.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was vice president and president back in those days,
Yep.
so I feel Carl's pain and Guy's pain because of course, as vice president, you have to re you have to arrange to get speakers. Which it was always a fun activity, and then as the president, of course, we used to run the meetings with Robert's Rules of Order, which I never quite understood, but apparently it was good enough for the Senate, it was good enough for us. So anyway.
Yeah. So your article on a homemade telescope that you made, I think you call it Big Blue Eyes or something like that.
Oh, Old Blue Eye.
Old Blue Eye. Yeah,
Yeah.
that inspired me to make my first telescope. So
Oh,
thanks.
good. Well, Old Blue Eye sadly no longer exists. I still have the mirror. But the telescope that I got from the silent auction is basically the replacement for Old Blue Eye. So I think I'm going to have to call it Big Green.
Yeah, it is. And that was made at the Adler Museum in Chicago by a young lady at the time. And she brought the whole telescope here to DC.
Yeah, it's a very nice telescope. I've upgraded it a little bit, and I've had it out a few times, and it's been a lot of fun to work with. So,
Yeah, she did a really nice job on the optics, and I redid, the Dobsonian base. That's all my work,
right.
what it's worth. And I hope that part's okay too, huh?
Oh yeah, that's great.
Great. Okay, that's all I got. Carl.
Could everyone hear Guy pretty well online? Okay, good.
Yeah, I did.
Good, thank you.
Hi, Jeff. Good to see you for the first time.
Ah, yes.
So as you may have gathered, Tonight's speaker is Dr. Jeff Chester.
I should point, I am not a real doctor, but I have played one on TV.
Well, that's why I said it.
Oh, okay.
Okay, thanks. See, I'm throwing off already.
It's all right. Just want to set the record straight.
Okay, good, thanks. So, Jeff recently retired from the United States Naval Observatory as a public affairs officer and historian for over 27 years. And you may, most of us probably know that the Naval Observatory is located in this beautiful area of Upper Massachusetts Avenue in DC, inside, I guess, in the upper end of Embassy Row. And inside what's the street called Observatory Circle, which also happens to be where the United States Vice President resides. Now, I often wondered what it was like leaving work late in the afternoon and waving to the Vice President who was coming back from the White House, coming back home. I don't know if that ever happened to them.
That never really happened because they blocked all the streets
I
off and you
figured
couldn't
that.
get close, so.
And you previously worked at the Einstein Planetarium at the National Air and Space Museum.
That's right.
So I was,
Dave Dvorkin and I have can spin lots of tales about that.
I bet. So I took the liberty to look at your LinkedIn account where I saw you. Made an entry, I guess, around the time of your last of your retirement, which was, I take it, just a few weeks ago,
November 1st.
November 1st. So you write, between my time at the Air and Space Museum and my time here, meaning the Naval Observatory, I've managed to have two of the coolest jobs one could hope for over some 46 years. I've met with some amazing people, including all the vice presidents since Al Gore. Military leaders from around the world, and mostly some of the most amazing scientists who made up our staff. So it sounds like a very interesting career. I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say about it. Jeff is also a member of the AAAS and NOVAC, the Northern Virginia Astronomy Club, as well as several other astronomy organizations. And as we already talked about, he was past president of this organization. As the abstract says, the abstract for this talk, the Naval Observatory is one of the oldest scientific agencies in the country, and from what little I know about it, it seems that it does some really interesting aspects of astronomy, coming at astronomy from some very interesting angles. So tonight's talk is entitled by Jeff, Sky and Ocean Joined, Scaling the Stars at the U.S. Naval Observatory. So let's welcome Jeff Chester.
Thank you. All right, so let me make sure I can get this thing to work here. There we are. So this is my talk, Stars, Sky and Ocean Joined. And just a little bit about me. The picture on the left shows a fairly young version of me, having just graduated from Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Worcester, Mass. This was a picture that was taken at Stellafane in 1976. I am sporting there not only my longer hair and my skinnier self, but also my 3-inch Mertz-Utschneider and Fraunhofer refracting telescope that I actually found at my brother-in-law's house. He'd gotten it from a junk shop in New York City. And with my old astronomy club, the Aldrich Astronomical Society in Worcester, we restored it and I exhibited up at Stellafane that year. And It was certainly the oldest telescope that they've seen at Stellafane, at least that year. I'm not sure how many older ones have been since then. But I still have the telescope. It actually is not very practical for astronomy, but it looks really great in the living room. And then on the right, you can see that I have a somewhat large, or had a somewhat larger telescope. That is the 12-inch Clark Sagemuller refractor at the U.S. Naval Observatory, completed in 1895. So I want to
They didn't
start
let you take
with,
that home, right?
sorry?
They didn't let you take that one home, huh?
No, it's pretty hard to sneak past the guards. And it wouldn't fit in my car. So, I mean, there are some other telescopes there that I'd also like to sneak home, but hopefully we'll be able to figure our way to that I can get back up there to use it. That's the main thing that I'm worried about right now. But let's start at the beginning. On December 6th of this past year, the U.S. Naval Observatory celebrated the event that was essentially its founding in the year 1830. That was the year, or that was the date, December 6th, when the gentleman on the left, Lieutenant Lewis Goldsborough, received orders from the Secretary of the Navy to establish in Washington a depot for the proper care, repair, and most importantly, calibration of all of the U.S. Navy's navigational instruments. Now, this was really a practical matter for Goldsborough because in the late 1820s, he was on a ship that was being delivered to the Asiatic Squadron. And of course, in those days, there was no Suez Canal, there was no Panama Canal. And the way that you basically reached the Far East was you sailed across the Atlantic Ocean, made landfall to provision in West Africa, sailed around the Cape of Good Hope, and then across the Indian Ocean. And if you played your cards right, you wound up in Hong Kong or Singapore or whatever you were aiming for over there. So they were 45 days out of New York. And they were expecting to make landfall on the west coast of Africa, but instead woke up one morning and found themselves bobbing around merrily in the middle of the Cape Verde Islands, well over 100 nautical miles away from where they thought they were. Now, at this point in time, the art of celestial navigation using the chronometer method had gotten to the point where a competent navigator could determine the true position of a ship. To within 1 or 2 nautical miles of its actual location. So an error of 100 nautical miles was pretty significant. So Goldsborough realized once they got to West Africa and started to reprovision that there was something not quite right here. So he took it upon himself to examine all the work that the navigator on the ship had done, make sure that the sextant readings were correct, and the log books and the reduction tables and the almanacs and everything, all the calculations had been done properly. And everything turned out to be just fine. The one thing that he didn't have any information on was the running rate of the ship's chronometer. In 1830, there were no domestic suppliers of marine chronometers. All the chronometers that the Navy had, and at that point, there were about two dozen of them, and it's an inventory. All came from clockmakers in England. And getting a new chronometer was therefore a non-trivial operation. You had to sail to England, you had to pay a clockmaker a fairly handsome sum, and then sail back. And you sort of had to take the clockmaker's word as to what the daily rate of change of that clock was. So, in the case of this particular voyage, the clock that was on Goldsborough's ship was rated as gaining 3 seconds a day. Goldsborough took it upon himself to do some very rough trials using a noon transit method, and he was able to determine that the actual rate of the clock was more like 12 seconds a day. And this, of course, is an error that compounds on a daily basis. So it was fairly easy to account for the huge error in their estimated position because they didn't have the correct rate of their chronometer. So when Goldsborough got back to the United States, he wrote a letter to the Secretary of the Navy saying that the Navy needed an institution where they could have essentially a central location to store and repair and calibrate all of the Navy's navigational instruments. So Goldsborough sent this letter to SecNav in November of 1830. And 3 weeks later, he got orders to establish what became known as the U.S. Navy Depot of Charts and Instruments. And that order was acknowledged by Goldsborough on December 6th of that year. And so that's what we consider our birthday. Now, I don't know how many of you have been in the military or worked in the military, but the idea that a lieutenant could write to the Secretary of the Navy and get action in 3 weeks is something that doesn't happen every day. But as it turns out, Goldsborough had a bit of an in. It always pays to have friends in high places in Washington. His father, as it turns out, was the chairman of the Navy Board of Commissioners, which is the civilian board that essentially told SecNav what to do. And his father-in-law was the Solicitor General of the United States. So with friends like that, you'll get things done. Goldsborough was given a budget in for fiscal year 1831 of the grand sum of $330 plus a lieutenant's salary. Well, most of that had to go to rent because he needed to have a building that he could do all of his activities in. And one of the things that he realized is that if you are going to build a facility that is going to be calibrating chronometers, well, the only time scale that we had available at the time to do that was the time scale determined by the mean rotation rate of the Earth itself. And there's only one way that you can measure that, and that is astronomically. So if you're going to build a facility that's going to be calibrating chronometers, you have to build an astronomical observatory of some scale in order to do that. He looked around and was finally able to find a building that suited his needs. The annual rent was $250, so that chewed up most of his annual budget. And the reason that the rent was so cheap was that it was located in a part of the city in those days, which I guess was considered to be a fairly sketchy part of town, 17th and G Streets Northwest, which is just a couple of blocks from the White House. That neighborhood has changed a little bit since then. But
Jack,
you can, yes.
have you been changing slides? Because
No, no.
okay, just wanted to make sure. Because
Yep.
thank you.
I want to get through Goldsboro and then we'll
Sure.
work. Then things will happen more rapidly. But keep your eyes on these three faces for a while. You can tell by looking at Goldsboro that there he is. Nobody's going to give him any grief at night. So anyway, so he was the officer in charge of the depot for 3 years. He was relieved by this gentleman here, Lieutenant Charles Wilkes. He was subsequently relieved in 1837 by Lieutenant James Gillis. So this was the original location of the observatory, 17th and G Street, the G Street Depot over here. And you'll see over here the Capitol Hill Observatory. This was where Lieutenant Charles Wilkes, thank you. This is where Lieutenant Wilkes decided to relocate it because he happened to have a house that was right at that location on North Capitol Street, not too far from the present-day site of Union Station. Rather than commute to that sketchy part of town, he decided he'd just move it into his backyard. And he was a man of fairly independent means, so this is a rather fanciful view of what the Capitol looked like, allegedly from the Virginia shoreline. This house over here that you can see in the corner there is probably the location of where Wilkes's house was. It was a great spot to do astronomy from, but there was one problem, and that was there was this very large building with a dome on it that had cut off that blocked off about 10 degrees of the southern sky and interfered with some of the transit circle observations. But despite that, Wilkes was able to do the first really practical and began cataloging some of the standard stars that we used for timekeeping. Now, even up to this point, we didn't have enough money in the budget to purchase instruments. So Goldsborough and Wilkes were able to parlay a transit instrument made for the Coast Survey to essentially be on semi-permanent loan to the fledgling Depot of Charts and Instruments. And this instrument was set up at the Capitol Hill Observatory. Now, of course, a transit instrument is a very specialized kind of telescope that can only look along an imaginary line that goes from north to south and through the point directly overhead. And we observe the instant that a celestial object crosses or transits that meridian line. We can predict for any given location when an object is going to cross that line. So it follows that if we observe the event with some reasonable degree of precision, we have an anchor point that we can use to establish a time scale. And that is basically the job that these early directors of the Depot of Charts and Instruments did. We have in our records some of the original observations that were made by Lieutenant Wilkes. This is a page from his 1836 logbook that shows the observation, the transit observations that he made of a number of different objects. But in 1837, Wilkes was tapped to lead the U.S. exploration expedition that lasted 4 years from 1838 to 1842. So he had two ships, the Vincennes, and I can't remember the name of the other one. But he set off with a bunch of scientists, botanists, all kinds of naturalists, and that sort of thing to do essentially a survey of as much of the world as possible. And he paid particular attention to the Pacific Basin. In fact, he is the one who finally determined that Antarctica was not just a random island somewhere. It was actually a continent. And there is a significant part of Antarctica which to this day is still called Wilkes Land. Well, when Wilkes got back in 1842, he ran into a few issues, one of which was that he had promoted himself and the lieutenant in charge of his other ship to the rank of captain when they crossed out of United States territorial waters. And when he came back in 1842, he demanded 4 years back pay at the rating of a captain. This did not sit well with the Navy brass. He was court-martialed, and ultimately he was acquitted. I don't think he got the money that he expected he was going to get. He was actually court-martialed again during the Civil War for a completely different reason. Once again, he was acquitted and ultimately made admiral. So it just goes to show you that you could be court-martialed and still do great things. But when the expedition came back in 1842, we run into a very interesting situation that involves John Quincy Adams. Adams, of course, was one of the first presidents who was elected through that cumbersome instrument that we call the Electoral College. And he was never very popular as president. But exactly 5 years to the day before the order was issued to Goldsboro to establish the Depot of Charts and Instruments, Adams gave a speech before Congress in which he claimed or he desired or voiced his desire to establish a national university. And attached to that university should be a national observatory. And he commented in his speech that in Europe, there were literally dozens of these so-called lighthouses of the sky. But in the American continent, there was not but one. There was not one. Well, he became the first and so far only vice president, or only president, who was subsequently elected to the House of Representatives. So when the exploration expedition came back, it was loaded with specimens, scientific notations, logbooks, all kinds of stuff. And at the same time, a gentleman named James Smithson from England bequeathed the sum of $500,000, which in 1842 was a pretty significant chunk of change, to the government of the United States to establish an institution for the increase and diffusion of knowledge. Well, Adams decided that this was his chance in the House of Representatives to get his long-sought observatory. So he lobbied very heavily that some of that money should be turned over to establish this observatory. But again, he was never very popular even in Congress, and that idea was shot down. Ultimately, all of the information, the logbooks, the specimens, etc., that came back from the Wilkes expedition became the fundamental collection of what is now the Smithsonian Institution. Well, at this point, Wilkes didn't want to have the observatory in his backyard anymore. And so he informed Lieutenant Gillis, who was his successor, to basically clear up and get the heck out of Dodge ASAP. So Gillis was able to find temporary quarters on Pennsylvania Avenue, but he really knew that what he needed was a permanent site. Because by the 1840s, the number of chronometers that we had to deal with, as far as calibration was concerned, had increased from roughly two dozen to well over 200. And Gillis was still basically a one-man show. So he was swamped with work. So he wrote a letter to the Secretary of the Navy saying that I can't do my job anymore, but if you can find it in the budget somewhere to come up with, say, a spare $10,000 or so, we can build a permanent site, staff it with competent people, put the state-of-the-art astronomical instruments into it, and really turn the place into a smooth-running organization that can satisfy the needs, the navigational needs of the Navy. Well, he didn't get a response in 3 weeks the way Goldsboro did. It was more like 6 months, and he finally heard back from SecNav, who said it was a nice idea. But so Gillis, also being a native Washingtonian, knew how the game was played. So he figured, well, I didn't get satisfaction going up my chain of command, so I'm going to go around my chain of command. He eventually ran into a senator from South Carolina, Senator Preston, who heard his pleas, heard his case, and also happened to know that the Navy had some pretty nice installations down in Charleston, and it would be nice for the Navy to continue funding those bases and expanding them. So he had kind of two purposes in mind. So Senator Preston introduced in Congress on the first Congress of 1842 a bill to appropriate the cost of $25,000 for the Navy to plus up its budget specifically for the purpose of building a permanent depot of charts and instruments. Well, Gillis, of course, was overjoyed. He began ordering instruments from Europe, the finest instrument makers. He began hiring staff, and he even designed the buildings that were ultimately going to be the first permanent site of the Naval Observatory. Unfortunately for him, in 1844, the incumbent SecNav was killed in the explosion of a cannon on a ship in the Potomac River that almost wiped out the entire cabinet of the United States. But the new SecNav that was appointed was from Virginia, and he wanted a Virginia naval officer to be in charge of the new observatory. So he appointed Matthew Fontaine Maury, which was a terrific disappointment for Gillis because he basically had done all the legwork to get the place going and start construction and everything. And all of a sudden, he was out of the running. And just to make sure that he didn't have any say in the matter, they got his detailer to send him to South America for 4 years. But while he was in South America, he built an observatory down there, which today is the National Observatory of Chile. So the new observatory was constructed. It was located in a part of the city which to this day is still known as Foggy Bottom. Let that sink in for just a moment. You can still see the old observatory today. It's across the street from the State Department, 23rd Street between D and E Streets. It was located there because they left the decision of where to put it up to President John Tyler. He was the first president of the United States who was not elected president of the United States. He was William Henry Harrison's vice president, and he never really liked Washington, so he never really got to know the place that well. So when he was given four choices to site the observatory, he said, "That hilltop over there east of Georgetown looks good. Let's put it there." Apparently, nobody told him that the region was known as Foggy Bottom. If they did, he didn't care. But in those buildings, we obtained from finest instrument makers in Europe some of the state-of-the-art transit instruments that were built at the time. And we also obtained a very nice 9.6-inch Mertz und Mahler refracting telescope known as the Great Telescope. The lens for this telescope is now in the collection of the American Museum of or the Museum of American History at the Smithsonian. Debbie Warner, I think, has it. Used to be on display. I don't know if it's in a drawer upstairs now or not. David could probably fill us in more on that. But this was the observatory's main telescope from 1845 up until 1873. It, however, did not go unused. One of our early astronomers, James Ferguson, was at the observatory for over 20 years. He was a prolific observer with the 9.6-inch telescope. He made the first asteroid discovery from the United States in 1854, discovered two more asteroids in 1857 and 1860. He was rewarded the Lalande Prize in 1854 and 1860 for his asteroid discoveries, and he published more than 90 papers during his career, more than any other pre-Civil War American astronomer. An interesting thing happened, though, after the Civil War broke out. We hired a young astronomer who had been an observing assistant up at Harvard Observatory named Asaph Hall. Asaph Hall was a very prolific and dedicated observer, and but he got to do all kind of the grunt work, the fun, the measurement of double stars and things that were just kind of, very, very routine types of observations. One night in July of 1863, the observatory received word that the president and some of his senior cabinet members wanted to come to the observatory for an official visit. Asaph Hall, being the junior astronomer, drew the short straw, and so he was the one that got to entertain the official party. So they come over. And they look at the moon and the bright star Arcturus in the 9-inch telescope, and then everybody goes home. Well, the old observatory, to get to the 9-inch telescope, you had to go up a stairway that wrapped around the masonry pier of the telescope to the roof of the observatory, and you had to go up through a trap door in order to gain access to the observing deck. And one of the problems that we tended to have was that when the taverns closed in Georgetown, people would stagger home. And very often, if they saw that there might have been a light on in the dome of the telescope, they'd go into the observatory and decide they were going to see what the astronomers were looking at. The astronomers, of course, got used to this. And what they would do was essentially take a heavy desk and put it over the trap door so that nobody could barge in on them. Well, at 2 o'clock the following in the morning, following the official visit, Paul is busy doing his rote work, And there is this sudden and very intense pounding on the trap door. And it goes on for 10, 15 minutes. Paul figures it's some drunk from Georgetown trying to get in to see what he's, see if he could get a peek through the telescope. And it persists. So finally, Paul decides he's going to give this guy a piece of his mind, pulls the desk off the trap door, opens the trap door, and up comes a stovepipe hat, underneath of which is Abraham Lincoln, who had walked by himself from the White House at 16th and Pennsylvania Avenue over to the observatory at actually 24th and D Streets, by himself, unescorted. And the reason that he came was that he could not get to sleep that night because he had this burning question in his mind, which was, why did the moon look backwards in the telescope? In a previous life, Lincoln had been a surveyor. And looking through a surveyor's theodolite, everything is rectified. Up is up, right is right, so on and so forth. He couldn't understand why the moon appeared upside down in the telescope. So Hall patiently explained to him that this was how the optics of astronomical telescopes worked. Apparently, it satisfied Lincoln. He went back and became a fairly frequent visitor, kind of under the table, no official visits. But if he knew that Hall was going to be observing, he would come over and they would spend an hour or so together looking at things through the telescope. And then he would let Hall get back to work. And his son Robert Todd Lincoln became a very avid amateur astronomer and spent a huge amount of time at the observatory long after the assassination of his father. In fact, he built a very nice observatory at his house up in Manchester, Vermont, that had a beautiful 6-inch Warner and Swasey telescope with an Alvin Clark lens. Robert Todd Lincoln became a very, very avid astronomer. Well, to give you an idea of the setting at the time, this is kind of a view of Washington in the early 1860s. You can see they're putting the new dome on the Capitol here. Here's the observatory over here. And you'll notice that there is this large canal that runs down from the or from the Capitol area down here into the Potomac. This is the Washington Monument being built. So all that area that the Lincoln Memorial and East and West Potomac Park are in, that would all be out here in the riverbank. That's all reclaimed land. And you'll also notice that there is this body of water which curves off from this canal over here. The area that the observatory was on was basically a hilltop that was surrounded on three sides by river bottom swampland, into which drained these canals and various creeks, which were effectively the septic system of the city in those days. So the Naval Observatory was surrounded on three sides by the biggest open sewer in town. I often wonder what it must have been like on a nice July evening if you were the astronomer working in the 9-inch telescope and you open up that dome slit and the south wind has been blowing across this swamp that's been percolating in the 98 degree sunshine all day. Must have been aromatic at best, and at worst, you were probably surrounded by clouds of malaria carrying mosquitoes. It was a terrible place to do astronomy from. In 1879, one of the superintendents did a survey of the number of nights when we could use our largest telescope to its full advantage, and the grand total for that year was 20. So it was not exactly what one might call photometric. But during the course of this time, we had a number of individuals who stepped in and began elevating the observatory's stature. First of these was Rear Admiral Charles Henry Davis. He had been appointed as the head of the Nautical Almanac Office in 1849, and he hired a fellow by the name of Simon Newcomb at that time. And at that time, the office was located up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So Davis also had the advantage of the astronomers and scientists at Harvard Observatory. But in 1867, he moved the deep, or he 1865, he moved the Nautical Almanac Office down to Washington, where it became affiliated kind of loosely with the U.S. Naval Observatory. And of course, Simon Newcomb was the head of the Nautical Almanac Office, the chief scientist, and he is generally recognized as one of the principal American scientists of the 19th century, even though he was Canadian. So 1867 comes along, and a new superintendent comes on board, and that's Rear Admiral Benjamin Franklin Sands. And Sands was a grizzled Civil War admiral, but he also took the observatory and its cause very seriously. So he wrote in his reports to his superiors in annual reports in 1867 and 1868 that the one thing that the observatory was lacking was a really good telescope. The 9.6 inch just couldn't cut the mustard for him. And he was adamant to point out that there were a number of colleges, high schools, well-heeled amateur astronomers who had larger telescopes than what was supposed to be the National Observatory. And to Sands, this was nothing less than a national disgrace. Well, Newcomb also had a reason to want a larger telescope because he had found that his ephemeris tables for the positions of Jupiter and Saturn didn't reflect where they actually were in the sky. Newcomb had a pretty big ego, but even he recognized that it was not Jupiter or Saturn's fault that they weren't where he thought they should be. It was his calculations. But he also realized that we did not know at that time anything about the masses of the planets Uranus and Neptune, and they would obviously be perturbing the positions of Jupiter and Saturn. So he wanted a large telescope so that he could measure the motions of the moon, the moons of Uranus and Triton, the large moon of Neptune, so that he could use Kepler's laws to determine the mass of the two planets and therefore factor that into his calculations for Jupiter and Saturn. One of the other things that Admiral Sands pointed out was that, again, it was nothing short of a national disgrace, especially considering that the finest telescope maker in the world at the time was an American in the form of Alvan Clark and his sons. So finally, in 1870, funds were appropriated for the construction of what became known as the Great Equatorial Telescope. The telescope had to be exclusively of American manufacture and not cost more than $50,000. It ultimately came in with a price tag of just under $48,000. And in November of 1873, it saw its first light. And here is Newcomb and Admiral Sands around that time. Very elegantly posed next to this marvelous new machine. So Newcomb more or less had exclusive use of the telescope for the first few years of its operation. He was able to make his observations of Uranus and Neptune, but he was never really an observer. He was much more of a theoretician. So in 1876, he turned the telescope over to none other than Asaph Hall, who had risen in seniority. Hall made a discovery almost immediately after he took over the telescope. In 1876, he observed a white spot in the equatorial region of Saturn. And by measuring the central meridian transits of this spot, he was the first person to determine a reliable figure for the rotation period of Saturn. His figure is differs from the modern value by something on the order of 10 minutes. But his real claim to fame was over a series of hot August nights in the year 1877, when he discovered Phobos and Deimos, the two moons of Mars. So we have in the library on display the original logbook from August 17th, 1877, which is the night that he discovered Phobos. These are his observations of Phobos down here. And there's a little note here which says, and this was his measurements of Deimos, which he had discovered a few nights earlier. And once he found Phobos, he wrote in the logbook, "Both the above objects, faint but distinctly seen by G. Anderson and myself." George Anderson was his observing assistant. So for 24 hours, he and George Anderson were the only two people on the planet that knew of the existence of these two moons. But of course, we know it's not real unless the boss sees it. So the next night, he's out in the dome, and all the senior brass of the observatory are out there. The next 5 pages of the logbook are measurements that are made of all the senior scientists and astronomers. There's a cryptic note at the bottom of this page, though. It said Newcomb made all the measures on this page. And if Newcomb saw it, then it had to be real. And just to give you an idea of how difficult it is to observe these things, this is a picture of Phobos that I took with the 12-inch telescope. And that's about as far as Phobos gets from the planet. Its elongations are very, very close to the planet. And you can see I had to mask out the glare of Mars in order to be able to photograph it at all. Well, the heyday of the observatory was upon us at this particular time. In the latter part of the 19th century, the observatory became an internationally recognized institution. We were put in charge of operating or overseeing the Transit of Venus expeditions of 1874 and 1882. 8 sets of instruments were built to deploy to various places around the world for each of these events. The idea being that we could measure the parallax of Venus by taking simultaneous photographs of the Sun with Venus in transit from a variety of locations across the surface of the Earth. This was an idea that was promulgated by William Harkness, who worked with Simon Newcomb. He was a very, very astute orbital mechanician, for lack of a better description. There were some 1,700 plates, glass plates, that were exposed at the 1874 and 1882 expeditions. Only 13 of those plates from 1882 have survived. And this is a print made from one of them. This was taken from Florida in 1882. But there is Venus recorded on the disk of the sun. The reason that Harkness wanted to do this was by measuring the parallax of Venus, we could then determine its precise distance, and then we could determine the fundamental distance of the Earth to the sun, the figure which today is known as the astronomical unit. But needless to say, Foggy Bottom was not a good place to do business from. In 1879, we got a new superintendent, Admiral John Rogers, and he began in earnest looking for a new site to situate the observatory. After examining some 40 locations around the District of Columbia and surrounding areas, he selected a site that was on a farm in the hills above Georgetown. And it was a 75-acre plot of land, and the family that owned it, the Barber family, were more than happy to sell it to Uncle Sam for the price of about $50,000. Unfortunately for, and this was in 1881. Unfortunately for us, in 1882, Admiral Rogers died as a result of malaria contracted while working down at Foggy Bottom. And for the next decade, we had a series of superintendents who were basically grizzled old Civil War admirals on twilight tours who really didn't want to do anything except serve their 2 years and get the heck out. It wasn't until 1890 that we began actual construction of the buildings, and it wasn't until 1893 in May that we were actually able to finally move to the site that we have been occupying since that time. And this is what it looked like in 1893, before all the trees and everything grew in around it. One of the things that's interesting about this is that the Navy in those days had enough clout so that they could get architects to submit bids for designs of the new building. And the architect whose design was ultimately chosen turned out to be a gentleman by the name of Richard Morris Hunt, who was considered the dean of 19th century American architects. If you've spent any time up in Newport, Rhode Island, and admired some of those quaint little summer cottages on the Ocean Walk up there, like the Breakers, well, that was designed by Richard Morris Hunt. If you have been to the Biltmore Estate in Asheville, North Carolina, little 100,000 square foot cabin in the pines to keep George Vanderbilt Jr. out of trouble, well, that was designed by Richard Morris Hunt. He designed a number of buildings in New York City. The ones that are still remaining are the facade for the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the pedestal for the Statue of Liberty. So we feel like we're in pretty good company. This was actually Hunt's first government contract, and Uncle Sam liked the work so much that they commissioned him to design a couple of the buildings up at West Point, but we don't talk about those. So we moved a lot of stuff up to the new observatory site, but the Great Equatorial saw a major renovation at this time. The old mounting that had been designed by the Clarks with input from Simon Newcomb was found to have a number of shortcomings. So by this time, the firm of Warner and Swayze had established themselves as the preeminent telescope mount makers of the day. They had, of course, mounted the 36-inch telescope at Lick Observatory. They were in the process of building the mounting for the 40-inch telescope at Yerkes Observatory, and they redesigned and built a new mount for us at the U.S. Naval Observatory. This mounting had a number of interesting innovations in it. Among those was a floor which rises and falls. It's the largest elevator in the city of Washington, but it always puts the astronomer at a convenient location so they can sit in the nice comfy chair to make their observations. This was the second time that the lens had actually been taken apart and cleaned. As far as I know, it has been cleaned subsequent to that time. It has been taken apart and cleaned three more times. This was the most, up until recently, this was the most recent cleaning, which took place in the 1960s. And you can see here the crown and the flint elements of the lens. I have not actually seen them outside of their cell. But of course, we have the old expression that a dirty lens performs a lot better than a poorly cleaned one. So it still works to this day. The telescope is actually still in use as a mission-related observing instrument. We use it for a dedicated program to observe the astrometric properties of binary star systems. We have replaced the old moving wire micrometer with a device called a speckle interferometer, which is essentially a high-speed CCD camera, and it allows us to make very precise measurements of the separation and position angle of double stars, limited only by the optical characteristics of the telescope. So we can make measurements down to equal magnitude pairs, down to a separation of about a quarter of an arc second. The Washington Double Star Catalog has about 50,000 observations made with this instrument. It is the most prolific double star observing instrument in the world and the oldest continuously operating scientific or professional grade telescope in the world. We also got new instruments made by Warner and Swayze. The 6-inch transit circle was placed into commission in 1899. It made its last official observation on the day after the centennial of its first in 1999, so we can honestly say it was in use for over 100 years. It now graces the main hallway of the main observatory building. This is my favorite telescope, the 12-inch Clark Segmuller Equatorial. This was commissioned. The mounting was finished in 1892. It was built by George Segmuller, who was an instrument maker here in Washington. You can actually go and visit Segmuller's house, which is now the headquarters for the Knights of Columbus in North Arlington. Fascinating house if you ever get a chance to go up there and see it. And the lens, as I said, was made by Alvin Clark and Sons. My theory is that it was made by the actual grinding and polishing was done by Carl Lundin. It was delivered 2 years late because Lundin was working on the 40-inch lens at the same time. We also got a 15-inch Warner and Swayze Astrograph. This is one of the telescopes that I'm going to talk a little bit about in my presentation at the AAS this January. This telescope had a very checkered history, never really lived up to its expectations. But if you're interested in seeing it, you can go out to John Briggs's Astronomical Lyceum in Magdalena, New Mexico. He is the proud owner of this instrument. So, all through this whole period, one of our primary functions was still the rating and calibration of navigational instruments and specifically marine chronometers. The art of clockmaking had really progressed during this point, during this time. Although I find it interesting that we were using pendulum clocks, which we are actually were continue we continued to use pendulum clocks up through World War II as part of our clock ensemble. And when you think about it, that's pretty amazing because the pendulum clock was invented. First practical one was built in 1655 by Christian Huygens. So it's a technology that had 300 years of history behind it. Originally, the clocks were housed in a building which was located between the two east and west transit houses. We would make transit circle observations and take a mean of those observations, and that would allow us to compute time on the meridian of the clock house. In the clock house was a vault down in the basement, which contained a number of these reefer clocks. These were pendulum clocks that were operated in a vacuum, so you would have no influence of air resistance or significant temperature and humidity changes that could affect the clockwork mechanisms. They were very precise clocks. They could keep time on the order of a millisecond or so per day. And of course, we rated chronometers. So here is a photograph of one of the chronometer rating rooms. You can see there's a bunch of them on the wall up here. And then there's a case down here that has many more in there. And here is a reference clock, which was hooked up electrically to the reefer clocks so that we would be able to get a time tick to keep these reference clocks in the chronometer room on time. We also started doing time distribution throughout the United States. We entered an agreement with Western Union in the 1870s to begin transmitting time so that we could drop time balls in various locations where the Navy had Navy bases and that sort of thing. So New York, Boston, San Francisco, so on. And when standard time was adopted in 1883, we began transmitting a synchronizing tick to all the Western Union offices in the country at the instant of noon in the Eastern time zone. And each Western Union office had on the wall a clock which was designed to be synchronized to this telegraphic signal. So, starting in 1883, if you went into a Western Union office, and this was true up through the 1950s and early 1960s, you would see a U.S. Naval Observatory Western Union clock on the wall, and it would get its time hack every day, from the Western Union network. The ultimate derivation of the pendulum clock is represented by this thing over here. This is the short master-slave clock system. It differs from the reefer in that on the right-hand side there, you can see the tube that is evacuated, and that has a free pendulum in it. And that pendulum does not drive a clockwork mechanism. So it has virtually no friction to dissipate energy from the pendulum itself. But it was linked to a slave clock, which is on the left, that would be in a location where people wanted to know what time it was. And every 30 ticks of the master pendulum, it would send a synchronizing pulse out to the slave pendulum. This was the state of the art as pendulum clocks were concerned. And again, we ran these up through World War II. But we ran into a problem, and that was that we were exceeding the accuracy that was capable of being determined by transit circles. So we came up with a new way of determining time by the stars. And that was with a device called a photographic zenith tube, which is on the left image. That is essentially an 8-inch refracting telescope that stares straight up into the sky. Excuse me. Light from a star would go down through the lens. Halfway down the focal length of the lens, there was a pan of mercury down in a well about 10, 12 feet underground. That would then reflect the light back up, where it would fall on a small photographic plate. And the shutter for that photographic plate was triggered by a signal from one of the clocks. And it would photograph the star field directly overhead when a reference star was thought to be crossing the meridian. So we would then develop the photographic plate, see how far the star was from the actual meridian, and that would determine the error in our clock. This was a much more precise way of determining time, and it was through observations made with these photographic zenith tubes that we began to see that the Earth is really not quite the timekeeper that we suspected it was. And we began looking for better ways of keeping time. So in the 1930s, they began developing quartz crystal clocks. And this is a typical quartz crystal oscillator that dates back to the early 1950s. These quartz clocks were about 6 feet tall and weighed half a ton with all the equipment and power supplies and everything. I think it's kind of neat now that most of us are carrying them around on our wrists today. These are very, very precise timekeeping devices, capable of parsing the second into millionths of a second per day, but that still wasn't good enough for us. So we began looking into the development of atomic frequency standards. And this is our first Atomicron, the first commercially built cesium frequency standard. In a cesium frequency standard, we are measuring the oscillation between two hyperfine states of the binding shell electron in a cesium atom. And since electrons are very small, they can oscillate at very high frequencies. And this today is what defines the duration of the second. But we had to do one other thing before we could settle on this new definition. That was to link the astronomically defined second with a specific frequency of the cesium atom. That work was done at the Naval Observatory by this gentleman, William Markowitz, who built an ingenious camera that allowed him to simultaneously photograph the moon against a background of faint stars. And utilizing eight of these instruments deployed at various places around the world, he was able to make a determination of the duration of a timescale called the ephemeris second. And in 1967, he, working with physicists at the National Physical Laboratory in Great Britain, were able to come up with a number that linked a specific frequency of the oscillation of the cesium atom to the ephemeris second as defined at 1 January, the epoch of 1 January 1900. And in 1967, the world's physicists adopted this new definition of the second, which is 9,192,631,770 hyperfine transitions of a neutral cesium-133 atom in its ground state. I will be brutally honest and tell you when I started working at the observatory that I thought a second was one Mississippi. And for the most part, that still works. Over the years, we have developed, we have used the current or the ensemble of clocks that we use generally consists of about 100 commercial off-the-shelf cesium beam frequency standards and about 25 hydrogen masers. That was all well and good, but the requirements for the next generation GPS satellites basically required us to figure out a way to create a time scale that was roughly 10 times better than the time scale produced by hydrogen masers. So we hired a couple of atomic physicists, four of them, and under the aegis of this gentleman here, Dr. Chris Ekstrom, who is now the deputy oceanographer of the Navy, and Dr. Stephen Peel, who happened to be a graduate student of this gentleman over here. This is Bill Phillips from NIST. Bill Phillips won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1996 for determining a way to use lasers to trap and cool atoms to extremely low temperatures. Chris and Steve, Chris here and Steve, basically developed this into a functioning, what we call fountain clock, where we trap and cool atoms to about 1 million of a 1 millionth of a degree above absolute zero. And gently toss them into a microwave cavity where they go up and down under the acceleration of gravity. In this device, we can then measure the oscillation frequency of those atoms for a much longer period of time. Today, if we take a differential measurement between any of the six fountain clocks that we have built, the differences are measured at the femtosecond level, which is 1/1,000th of a trillionth of a second. But we're not quite done yet. We are currently working on optical frequency standards. And one of the reasons that I decided it was time for me to retire was, yes, I can rattle off the 9-digit number that represents the cesium frequency. But the head of our precise time department has told me that within 10 years, they're going to redefine the second in terms of an optical frequency, and I will have to learn 18 digits. Ain't going to happen, at least not on my watch. So these are the various types of time that we have to keep track of. I will not bother to go through all of these, but these are all various types of time that are useful for various applications. And as you can see, it's still something of a hodgepodge, a little bit of a dumpster fire as far as timing goes. But the fundamental point is that whatever time you need, we keep it. I don't need to go through this really. Standard time, everybody hates daylight time. That's all, water over the bridge, but or over the dam. But these are the reasons that we have the time system that we do. So the footprint of the Naval Observatory, today, we have our headquarters here in DC. We have our Flagstaff Station, which is located about 5 miles west of downtown Flagstaff, Arizona. And in case somebody trips over the big power cord here in Washington and disables the master clock, we have an alternate master clock facility co-located with the Space Force's Master Satellite Control Center at Schriever Space Force Base in Colorado. That can supply GPS and all the various other needs of the DoD with the required timescale precision should something happen here in Washington. So this is a modern view of the observatory today. You see it up on Massachusetts Avenue, and this is our Flagstaff Station, which was completed in 1950, or the was founded in 1955. The building was completed in the early 1960s. This is where we have our largest telescope. That is a 1.55 meter astrometric reflecting telescope. It's used for measuring parallax of nearby stars, and we are in particular measuring using it now to measure the parallaxes of extremely faint nearby objects, i.e. brown dwarfs. We also have the Ritchey-Chrétien telescope that was originally installed in Washington in 1934, where it was a dismal failure. But once it moved out to Flagstaff, its fortunes changed. This was the telescope that was used to discover the polarization of starlight. Of course, the 1.5 meter telescope was used by, there were some photographs that were taken of Pluto, so that Jim Christie and his colleague Bob Harrington here in DC could update their ephemerides for the planet Pluto. Jim Christie happened to notice that there was this lump that appeared on Pluto. About every 3 days, it would move from one side to this side over here, and it was periodic. So he deduced that it was probably an unresolved moon orbiting close to Pluto. Bob Harrington made the orbital determinations that proved that it was indeed a large moon of Pluto and predicted a series of mutual occultation and eclipse events, which duly took place. Using that, we were able to measure the combined mass of Pluto and its moon Charon, and we found that Pluto's mass was about one-tenth of what had been estimated for its mass up to that time. So if people want to know who to blame for killing Pluto, I hate to say it, but it's us. We also operate a transit circle, one of the few that's left on the planet, but this is used. It's robotically operated. It is used by a number of programs for measuring the positions of asteroids and other small bodies in the solar system. This is also out at our Flagstaff station. So, in addition to time, the other main function of the observatory is determining what's called the celestial reference frame. In the old days, we would use transit circle instruments to measure the positions of the brightest stars in the sky. These were our fundamental catalogs. And in order to account for precession, you would have to make observations, completely reobserve your fundamental catalog about every 50 years. Today, we use what's called very long baseline interferometry to measure the positions of quasars and active galactic nuclei. These are so far away that they show no apparent motion on the sky, and they make a great reference frame. So, position and time, those are basically the two things that we are tasked with doing. We also continue to produce star catalogs. This is currently our latest star catalog was produced with an array of four of these rather impressive CMOS chips here, arranged in a camera that was called the Four Shooter and attached to the back of an 8-inch astrograph here. We did a survey of the sky from Flagstaff and Cerro Tololo in Chile, and that produced our most recent catalog, the U.S. Naval Observatory Remote Astrometric Telescope. And this shows you what the density of our catalogs have evolved since the year 2000. The TECO 2 catalog, based on ground-based observations and Hipparcos data, the UCAC, which was the predecessor of the URAT catalog, and this is the same field of view in all these images that shows the URAT. We also are charged with determining the orbital, the orientation of the Earth's rotational pole and variations in its rotational speed. Yes, the Earth does move. It's a terrible timekeeper, but we're the people that have to keep track of that. So polar motion consists of motions that combined together have a period of about 435 days. These motions trace an area, kind of a spiral pattern that's about the size of a baseball park. There are a number of things that cause polar motion, some of which we understand, a lot of which we don't. And of course, there's a variation in the variability of the Earth's length of day. A lot of these are secular, that are caused by tidal interaction with the moon, but there is a long-term trend for increase in the length of day. And this is why we have that thing, that pesky thing that we call the leap second. The leap second, don't get me started on that. It will go away. Fortunately, they've finally decided that they're going to do away with it, but it's going to be about 10 years before it actually is implemented. And so it's something that I don't have to worry about anymore. So that's my talk. This is the motto of the observatory and the seal designed by Rear Admiral Charles Henry Davis in 1867. And with that, I will be happy to take any questions that anyone has.
Jeff, this is Bernie Kaufman. I don't know whether you remember me. I spent many hours in the library at the main building,
Okay.
and I have designs on that Clark telescope there also.
That
I've been trying to figure out a way to get it out of the building and off of the observatory grounds, and I
Well,
haven't
good.
been able to do it.
Yeah, I know. You'll have to get in line behind David Dvorkin, though. I think he's got first dibs on it.
That 12 inches are an absolutely magnificent instrument. You have to look through it.
I've had some of the most amazing nights looking through that. And it's the thing. The problem now is that it's become very popular with people like the Secretary of the Navy and the Chief of Naval Operations. They have come up and availed themselves of the use of the telescope quite often, especially in the last several years. That's one of the things that I had to kind of tell my successor to be on the lookout for. But she's more than capable of she's more than up to the task of that. So I feel very good that it will still go and get noticed.
Okay,
So,
we have a question here in the room as well, Guy.
I was wondering if your time at the observatory had overlapped with that of Bob McCracken or Tom Van Flanderen.
No, I know that Tom worked there. I didn't, did Bob work there? Okay, I don't remember seeing him in the alumni list, but I'll have to take a look at that again.
Yeah, he was supposedly, very involved with the creation of the atomic clock, but
Okay.
and he was also president of NCA for a while.
Right. No, he was, in fact, he was the one that encouraged me to be the vice president and the president. So,
Okay. Bob McCracken.
This is Joan Dunham.
hi, Joan.
Bob McCracken did not work at the Naval Observatory.
Oh, he
Okay.
didn't. Yeah.
No, he might have been a frequent visitor, but no, he did not.
Yeah, he may have
I
worked with
did,
the.
but he
Yeah, I
didn't.
know you did.
Yeah. And I remember
And
the
Dave
12
did.
inch.
And
Nobody
David worked.
bothered, nobody wanted to use it when I was using it.
I know it's a very underutilized resource. I mean, it was actually it was used as a test bed for the first Markowitz, the prototype Markowitz moon camera, and then when he built the production cameras, he wanted to have identical telescopes for all of the eight stations. So they built a special 8-inch refractor that they placed in that dome. And they moved the 12 inch to building 39, where the 40 inch had been. And then in, that was in 1957. And then in 1970, they got a 24 inch Bowler and Chivins Cassegrain that they put in building 39. And they dismantled the 12 inch and basically stored it in pieces in various places around the observatory. So it wasn't until 1980 that Ted Rafferty and Rich Schmidt did the restoration of it.
Any other questions here in the room?
There is a question about, we have the same question whether it's open to the public. I see
Okay.
one in the chat too.
All right. So there, I know that we kind of covered it before the meeting actually started, but there's a question in the chat and here in the room about the observatory being open to the public. We can probably just do the short answer.
The short answer is unfortunately no. That's the very short answer. We were offering tours at various times. I started there in 97. We used to give Monday night tours every week. It used to be the first 90 people at the gate lined up and they got a pass and they got in. But that was back when we had CBs as CBs were our escorts, and we had our own police force. After 9/11, they closed access, they tightened up access to all military installations, and the tours were the first thing to go. And then in 2004, they regionalized the base operations support functions down to the Navy Yard, which meant we no longer had police, we no longer had CBs that could do the escort duties. I was able to convince them to allow volunteers to come in and help as far as escorting was concerned. But by 2017, they suddenly woke up and realized that the master clock was a strategic resource. And the idea of having 60 people come in every other Monday that we knew absolutely nothing about to be escorted by people who were not employees of the observatory, that didn't sit well with the security folks. And so they eliminated the tours. And that's where we are today.
Mr. Chester?
Call me Jeff, please.
Okay, I'm also Jeff.
Oh, okay. With a G or a J?
Jay.
Okay, well, I'm with a G, so that's how you can tell us apart.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, I went to an open house at the Naval Observatory to observe the aftermath of the Shoemaker Levy.
Shoemaker Levy 9. Yep.
Yeah, I
I remember
volunteered
it
there
well.
for that.
Yep.
Can you do you know what? I don't remember what year that was. That was before.
1994.
Okay. So they hadn't closed things off by then.
No.
Actually, from a small telescope, you could see where the comet had crashed into Jupiter.
Yep. Well, the thing that was funny was I was there that night and I had my 8-inch that Guy was talking about, old Blue Eye, at the observatory, and David Levy was walking up the path towards the main building, and was walking by where I had the 8-inch telescope set up on the lawn. And I knew David from, I've known David for years from that 1976 in Stellafane was when I first met him. And I said, David, you got to come over here and check this out. And he looked through my telescope and saw the first of the big black impact scars through that telescope. So that was his first view, was through my telescope, which I always thought was kind of cool.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
think he also saw the impacts through the 12-inch, and I think
Yes.
those were the most fantastic views of Jupiter he had ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I got a comments and questions. You mentioned Goldsboro. There is a Goldsboro Road in D.C., which I assume is named for him.
It's either named for him or his father.
Ah.
I'm not sure which one.
Also, you mentioned that the Smithsonian has the 9.6 lens. I volunteered down at Air and Space, and even though we have a I think it's a 16-inch Bohler and Chivins,
Right.
it would be very interesting. I got to talk to David Dvorkin about maybe taking that lens out and mounting that and using that also in the observatory when we get the observatory back and running.
Right. Well, I think Debbie Warner is retired now, but I don't know who is who's running her collection anymore. But David, I'm sure, has all the dope on that. I'm sure he's probably entertained that thought himself.
Yeah.
Okay, we have a question here in the room. Go
All
ahead.
right.
I just wonder if you could say a little bit about light pollution over the years. I guess if the like 19th century, there wouldn't be much of anything. I mean, has there been things to compensate or the type of observations you can make and not make over the years? I wonder if you'd say a little bit about that.
Did you hear him?
Light pollution. Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons that we moved up to, so in the, By the 1870s, the region around Foggy Bottom, they had started filling in the swamps a little bit. But one of the big problems that we had was just to the west of us was the old Hyrick Brewery, which is now where the Kennedy Center is. And I don't know if you've ever stood downwind of a brewery, but it can get a little aromatic at times. To the south of us, of course, was this open sewer. To the north was the coal gas works, where they essentially cooked coal to extract methane for the municipal streetlight system. So the wind could blow out of three of the four cardinal directions and just make life miserable. And when the wind blew out of the east, which was the only direction that we didn't have something stinky in the way, that generally brought clouds. So it was a terrible place to do astronomy from. So one of the sites, the site that they chose, the Georgetown Heights site, was chosen because it was far enough out of the city that we didn't have any problem with light pollution. It was all agricultural in those days. So we actually had a dark sky site that we could work with. That lasted until about 1910, which was when they built the Glover Bridge that brought Massachusetts Avenue out into that neighborhood. And by then, a lot of the farms had all been carved up and bought. A lot of that property was bought by Grover Cleveland, who then sold off building lots to his wealthy friends. And of course, they wanted to have a nice broad avenue to drive their newfangled automobiles up and down when they went to work in town. So I consider that area about the era from about 1910 to about 1920 as when, as far as we were concerned, the neighborhood started going downhill.
Speaking of aromas, I remember canoeing on the Potomac River near what is now the Kennedy Center, and there was a fat rendering plant in that region.
Okay, yep.
That stunk like it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And of course, if you've ever been near or in the Naval Research Lab,
Blue Plains.
that's next to Blue Plains, and if the wind is right,
Cool.
it'll. Yeah, I smell blue planes over here in Alexandria every now and again.
Any other questions here in the room?
Well,
Any questions online?
okay.
Yeah.
Let's give Jeff a big hand. Thank you.
Very, very interesting. Enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate the feedback. And again, sorry I couldn't have been there in person, but that's, now I'm still recovering from 50 Cub Scouts. So.
Yep, nope, fair enough. All right, well, thank you very much. Stopping recording now.